Thanks very much, Don. It's really a pleasure to be here, and it's good to see a lot of old friends and a very, very impressive setup. And again, I'm just very, very happy to be here. I think this is, I feel like I've been giving this speech now for about 5 years, just in the sense that here we are, another interesting year, another round of price spikes, and so unlike, in one sense, how I spent the first 25, 30 years of my career, where we would see a big uptick in prices and then see a very big global response and then back to low prices for a number of years. This has been sustained. We know what a lot of the drivers have been, strong world economy, strong growth, particularly in Asian markets. We also know with biofuel production how that's been such a stimulus on demand and on prices as well. And then you add to that mix some key production shortfalls like what we had in the U.S. this summer. You understand at least why we've seen the volatility we've seen. Well, what I'm going to do today is focus on the outlook for grains and oilseeds. I'm going to have a little bit in here on certainly spend some time with the U.S. situation, also talk about the world. At the end of the package I have, or the presentation, I had included some material on the U.S. livestock sectors and things like U.S. farm income. I won't probably get to that today. It will be available in my presentation, which I understand will be you'll be able to download it off the website. So let's start then. Well, again, what looked like was going to be a great year. We had very good soil moisture, started out, or we had early ideal weather to plant. It looked like we were going to have, largest areas certainly since the 30s for corn, and what we thought would be record yields. Turned out, of course, what happened is we had a drought, that one of the worst droughts we've seen certainly for many years. And because of that, a dramatic reduction in yields, both for corn and soybeans, and some other spring-planted crops, with record-high commodity prices following. And again, as I mentioned, this is after seeing a price spike in 2007, 2008, and then the other one with the problems in the former Soviet Union in the wheat crop in 2010-11. And so, you know, here we are back in terms of record-high prices. Now, interestingly, the U.S. for the U.S. Sector, the producers will likely see, the sector at least, will likely see record farm income, at least in nominal terms, that is, not adjusting for inflation. Much of that due to the, as was mentioned, I think, when Carl was speaking, talking about the impact of crop insurance. We'll probably see indemnity payments near $20 billion this year. Again, a huge injection of cash into the sector that will help compensate for the losses that we've seen on the crop side. Food inflation, interestingly enough, is still declining right now, at least if you look year-over-year levels compared to where we again, were 12 months ago. But we do expect to see, as we see a contraction in the livestock sector and other things, we do expect to see some food inflation moving up. And certainly if you're in a developing country where the value of the farm or import value of that commodity is a much higher percent of the total food costs, you'll likely, in some of those markets, will have seen increases already. Because of strong prices, our agricultural exports across all products in the U.S. are expected to be both nominal and real, and even adjusting for inflation, record levels this year. But the other consequence of higher prices, of course, is that we are seeing a drop in ethanol production, which will have impacts on the maize side. Well, just to give you a quick overview of how this drought developed, if you were to go back last year, we had, of course, a very serious drought in Texas and the Southern Plains. And such a serious drought, it cut wheat production by about 50% in Texas last year. We did see some improved rainfall in late fall, winter in most of Texas, and so such that by springtime, you can see that there was some lingering dryness in the so-called panhandle part of Texas, and then a little patch of dryness in the southeastern U.S. I think the thing to note is that if you look at the key parts of the Midwest, where most of the corn and soybeans are produced, and the northern plains, we had very, very, very limited dryness. But that began to increase substantially as we moved through May and June. We saw this band of dryness moving up through Arkansas, Missouri, the western part of Kentucky into Indiana, and then that began to move northwards and westward throughout the most of the summer. And we had again compared. People will look at analog years and will compare this to the droughts in the U.S. in the 50s or in the 30s. I think for many purposes, the one that really stands out is 1988 drought, which affected a lot of the corn and soybean producing areas in the Midwest. I don't know how well you can see this. Again, if you'll be able to download the package. But this shows the crop conditions for corn. We do a weekly survey of crop conditions, as many of you know, as part of our crop progress report. And the blue line there represents what those crop conditions look like in 1988. And you can see there we had a very dry spring, and the crop conditions were very poor. I think the interesting thing to me is here with this crop, again, it started out as a record, what many people thought would be a record yields because of the early progress and generally good planting conditions, started to deteriorate as we had very limited rainfall, particularly in May and in June. And you can see that red line there, that middle red line, then actually fell below the 1988 conditions throughout the latter part of the summer, which is just to say this was a very, very serious drought indeed. This is just out of our yield, our crop production reports. It on the one axis, it shows the number of ears per acre. So that's measuring sort of plant population and how many ears. And you can see, if you look up at the, you can see where we had, when we had really good years, like 2008, 2009, 2010, in terms of yields, you know, we had fairly high ear counts and also pretty fairly high ear weights, the derived grain weight. Here, when we did our first estimates in August, we knew that the grain weights were going to be down. What we didn't yet have a very good handle on, however, was number of ears per acre. And you can see the dramatic adjustment then we made in September and then further adjustment in October. And that's brought us down to where we're now calling for a yield of around 122 bushels per acre. But again, very consistent with the drought that we saw and the fact that as we just didn't get to see the rain. And when the rain finally came, it came too late for development of corn. Good news, if there is good news, well, there's sort of good and bad news about the overall world corn picture, is that foreign, the rest of the world, the production of corn actually went up a little bit this year. Now, that was a number of offsetting things. We are seeing some decline in the EU. Certainly declines in Ukraine and other parts of the former Soviet Union, where they were hit by very hot weather during the summer as well. And we'll see that again on the wheat side, obviously. But again, that being offset by some increased production and what is here anticipated increased production in Southern Hemisphere, particularly Argentina, we're expecting them as they're planting their fields now to see better production prospects at the being harvested in early spring this coming year. If you look at rest of the world corn production, that is, this is the non-U.S. corn production, again, very dramatic increases over the last several years, as we've seen countries like Brazil, where their second crop, their second corn crop, their double cropped corn has actually exceeded the primary crop in terms of volume and increased production in places like South Africa and others. And again, emergence of the Black Sea region, so Ukraine and elsewhere, seeing increased corn production. And some of these areas are more variable in terms of yields. I think that point was made earlier today. But again, very important in terms of overall production. What this has meant, of course, is that because demand has remained very, very strong. If you look at global ending stocks as a percent of use, and then we measure that just by number of days, you can see that we're at the lowest level since the 73-74. And that has come down dramatically, again, following last year's poor corn harvest and then this year's really poor corn harvest because of the drought this year. And that's brought stocks down to a very low level. Now, I'll conclude with this, but I do think this is a situation that can turn around pretty rapidly. I think if we get this sort of area planted next year and a more return to trend yields, we should see some substantial stock building in the U.S., which I think will help improve this. But for the time being, of course, we're at very, very tight situation globally. Now, this is the U.S. balance sheet, and I apologize for those of you who are less familiar with bushels. And but the important thing here is perhaps that last column, and that shows the percent change from last year. And I think there the dramatic things that I see is that you know, we're seeing a very big a drop from last year. And remember that when at the time, say June, when we were doing our forecast, we were expecting record yields, record production. Corn production, we were expecting at 14.8 billion bushels. Since that time, we've reduced production, of course, by some 4 billion bushels or so. And as a consequence, we've also obviously had a ration, make reductions in use. We're now calling for feed use, which is down about 30% from the numbers that we were carrying in June. If you look at ethanol use, that's down about 10% from what we were carrying in June. And exports down 40%. Our corn exports in metric tons are estimated now around 29 million tons. That would be the lowest level since 1973-74. So again, some very dramatic impact on the balance sheet. As we've, with this reduced production, we've also seen the demand categories fall as well. Now, if I can talk a little about ethanol production, we've seen a fairly dramatic drop. What this chart shows is weekly ethanol production numbers, and I've annualized it, so I've put it in terms of if that production level for that week were to hold for a year, what that production level would be. Those horizontal lines show the renewable fuel standard for the maximum amount that can be applied towards the renewable fuel standard from corn-based ethanol. So currently under the renewable fuel standard, we're at 13.2 billion gallons. And you can see that for particularly the last fall, just prior, particularly November and December, in anticipation of the expiration of the blenders, the so-called blenders credit, and the tariff, that we were almost up at about 15 billion gallons on an annualized basis. We're currently, just 2 weeks ago, the production numbers were estimated at around $12 billion annualized. And again, a very big drop. That drop between 14.7 and 12 is roughly about the equivalent of about a billion bushels of corn. So we've seen some rationing on the ethanol side as well. If you look at ethanol prices, however, that they're still at a discount to gasoline, and at least on a volume basis, there is still plenty of incentives to blend ethanol if you're a gasoline blender. I might add, also because of the high octane ratings, or the oxygenate properties of ethanol, that there's also a potential or strong incentives to continue blending ethanol as well. If you look at the margins, however, because of higher corn prices, we have seen margins near sort of break-even levels, and I think that explains why, in fact, we've seen some capacity go unused over the last several months. But again, tracking very close to sort of the break-even levels. The other thing, which I won't spend much time on, but is the renewable identification numbers, so-called RINs, where they have been trading at very low levels. Now, these can be used by gas under the governing regulations for the renewable fuel standard. Gasoline blenders can use RINs to offset their commitments. That is, rather than actually purchasing ethanol and blending it into gasoline, they can purchase a certificate, the so-called RIN, and use that to meet their compliance requirements. Those prices have been quite low, and I think a lot of people were initially perplexed by this because, indeed, if these margins are with higher corn prices and the cost of ethanol increasing, then why wouldn't blenders be willing to instead purchase RINs and bid up that price a bit? And I think there the answer is largely because of the octane requirements and the fact that ethanol still, there's still profits in using that. And that chart I showed earlier shows that at least there's still some profitability there for ethanol blenders, which also argues that a waiver in the mandates, at least at this point, when I look at the RIN values, it suggests that a waiver would probably have little effect, at least in the short run. Longer term, very different story. The last thing, and I think this has implications for the future, is the so-called blend wall, and that's essentially what we refer to about how much ethanol can be absorbed into the transportation fuel supply. At the time the Energy Act was passed back in 2007, that green line there shows what was projected, and we were expecting gasoline consumption in the U.S. to increase and to continue to increase such that we would be about 150 billion gallons by 2013, 2014. You can see instead, of course, that gasoline production has fallen. It's fallen for a number of reasons. One, the high energy prices that we saw in 2007, 2008, and then more importantly, I think the global recession and particularly the sluggish growth here in the U.S. has cut gasoline consumption and the number of miles driven, and then also the increased fuel economy that we've seen also since then. The key thing here is that rather than the 150 billion gallons that were envisioned back in 2007, we're now looking at more 132 or so currently, and that's expected to remain at that level for a number of years to come. What that implies, then, if you're thinking of penetration of, say, ethanol into this market, rather than the 10% of, say, 150, which would be 15 billion gallons, we're at about the 13.2 or so billion gallon rate. And so that's what people refer to as the blend wall. And next year, the renewable fuel standard actually goes up to 13.8, which would imply if you can only absorb about 13.2, that the rest indeed would have to be exported. So I think challenges for the RFS, but I know you have plenty of speakers on that later today. So let me move over to soybeans quickly. And they're a very similar story, at least we had very poor conditions affecting most of the soybean belt. That began to change a little bit towards the end of the summer as we started seeing more rain, spotty, and I think that was also mentioned earlier, I think, by the governor in his remarks. But, you know, better rainfall than we had seen certainly in July and June. And I think as our own data has shown, we saw a further filling out of pods and better pod weights than what we had originally anticipated. Here's the chart that you can see compared to some of the better yield years back in 08 and 09. You can see that the number of pods per acre, very, very low. when we did our first assessment in September, and then in October, again, similar number of pods, not surprising, that should be very similar. But the pod weights, again, I think because of the improvements that we saw in the amount of rainfall and other things, that we did see some filling out and a slightly better overall situation in soybeans. Now, on the world side, of course, we're coming off of a devastating production shortfalls in South America, with Brazil and Argentina off considerably. Now, there, that production level is actually represented in the column saying 2011-2012. That was followed, of course, by the drought here in North America. So we've had very, very, very tight stock situation worldwide. We are anticipating, however, that with the high prices, we are expecting an increase in production and a more return to normal yields in Brazil and Argentina, and obviously Paraguay and Uruguay as well. So overall, Latin America, again, some big increases, increases on the order of 20 to 30% above what they were last year. And that should help alleviate the demand for protein, at least till we can get, hopefully, a return to normal yields in the U.S. as well. In terms of, if you look at ending stocks for soybeans, just suffice it to say, a very tight situation. This, again, reflects, you almost have to look at 2 years here because of the fact that the South American crop was devastated in 2011-2012, and our estimates for 2012-13 are mainly reflecting a poor North American crop. Again, the risk, of course, is that if we were to have back-to-back poor yields in South America, those stock levels would drop precipitously. But again, assuming a little more normal yields, we should see a stabilizing of the situation, and then again with U.S. rebuilding a bit next year. This is just the soybean balance sheet. Again, the critical thing there is really looking at what the impacts are. We see a 20% or so reduction, 25%. Looking at those impacts. 8% reduction from last year. I was thinking about what it was relative to our earlier estimates this year. But again, a tightened balance sheet. We did increase our production numbers a bit this last month. That really helped. I think we were expecting. We also increased crush. We increased exports because, again, the market for protein has been very, very strong, and we expect that to continue. Through this year, that we expect particularly China will continue to be a very big buyer of soybeans on the world market, and that includes from the U.S. Soybean meal, again, that's been a critical issue, particularly for feed supplies here in the U.S. Record prices that we've been seeing, cash prices for meal, again, just reflecting this demand and the fact of a short crop. Let me turn quickly to world wheat because they're The big news has been what's been going on in the former Soviet Union, Black Sea region, where, again, we've seen variable yields there. We've cut those production numbers. The issue, again, will be what's going on in Australia. I think the focus now is shifting to the second half of the 12-13 year as we've seen the southern hemisphere, and in particular what to expect off out of Australia. If you look at – oops, sorry – production numbers. You think back to 2007-2008, and there we saw a very, very tight situation, and I think world-ending stocks at about 125 million tons. You can see that came after 7 of the 8 years prior to that, we had had consumption exceeding production. Well, that changed a lot as we saw those record production levels come in 2008-2009. Again, producers were reacting to high prices. And then again last year with record production of wheat really helped rebuild stocks. This year, however, despite a good U.S. crop, we did see some reductions in Europe because of the drought and then also the Black Sea region. And again, with world stocks coming down a little bit, but not nearly as much as one might, again, not nearly the levels that we saw back in 2007, 2008, when we really were at a quite tight situation. The wheat balance sheet, again, nothing really, I won't spend much time on that. Let me turn briefly to rice, and there I think the good news on rice is another global record. We've had back-to-back-to-back record production in terms of world rice production. Hasn't gone up much, but still some increases there, and that's helped, I think, particularly if you think back at 2007, 2008, when we had all the problems in the rice market, a lot that weren't caused by production, a lot that were caused by government policies and everything, but this has been a real stable part of the grains picture this year, at least. And again, this was reflected in terms of looking at the global rice situation. U.S. rice, let me spend less time with that. And let me just say one word about cotton, only because it's important in the U.S. Because it competes with corn and soybeans and wheat for area. And remember that 2 years ago we had record high prices for cotton, and it was very difficult at a time when soybean prices were quite high. It was still very difficult to compete with the sort of prices that we saw for cotton, and we had some pretty big increases in cotton area. That has changed dramatically over the last couple of years as we've seen, one, increased cotton production, and then also the slowing of the world economy where the consumption side has been down a bit. And because of that, cotton prices have fallen. And I think as we're looking forward to this next year, that we will see some heavy demand and competition with cotton area for soybeans and corn and wheat. Well, let me just conclude, and again, the rest of my package is largely deals with the livestock situation and in the U.S. and other things. And so let me just conclude on this part of it, at least, that while we've seen this really tight situation for wheat, corn, and soybeans, I think that there are significant differences than what we saw earlier, certainly in 2007, 2008 in particular. You know, the wheat situation, I think, is measurably better just by virtue of the fact that we had three out of the last 5 years had global wheat record production records. And that has really helped rebuild stocks such that the level stocks that we're now looking at aren't nearly as tight as they were previously. On the rice side, as I said, very stable situation there. Demand's been strong, but we've had good production. The real issue has been on the feed side with corn and soybeans, and I think there it has had spillover into the wheat market, obviously, for uses wheat as a feed. But again, I think on the soybean side, with an improved harvest in South America, that should help start to moderate prices, and then we'll see in the spring with plantings, but presuming similar plantings in the U.S. and a return to normal yields, I think we should see some improvement on the soybean side. And likewise for corn, I think in many respects, for all the tightness that we see in the market right now, and particularly the pain that it is causing in the livestock and poultry and dairy industries, is still a fairly temporary situation, just in the sense that if we get similar area planted that we had last year, and I think most analysts are looking at, 95, 96 million acres, somewhere in that range, that a more return to normal yield should allow us to more than double ending stocks and really provide ample supplies with seen moderating prices. Well, with that, let me conclude and see if there are any questions.
What is your perspective on the increase of tillable farmland for crop production?
I'm sorry, the increase of what for crop
The farmland for crop production, yeah.
For area.
Increase of the production of farmland.
What? Yes, area?
Area.
Yeah,
globally. Area.
Certainly in the U.S., I think, we haven't seen much change in the number of tillable acreage. There is, we have area and long run conservation set asides. Some of that could come into production. We have seen a little of that come into production over the last few years. But really, if you look globally, that most people point to Brazil, South America, more both in terms of additional area, but also more efficient, more intensive use. And then Sub-Saharan Africa. Now, Sub-Saharan Africa, of course, hasn't been a very major player, but I think at least to date. But if one looks over the next 10 to 30 years, I think you'll begin to see that. And certainly Eastern Europe. And that has been, a big part of what we've seen in those markets, and particularly increase in wheat markets and increase in the feed grains, coming out of places like Ukraine, Russia. However, looking out over the world food needs over the next 30 to 40 years, I think clearly most of that, and most analysts think that most of that's going to have to come from yield increases, not area.
Yes, Budi from Indonesia. The price is very much concerned for the customer in Asia regarding what the feed. If you look at the corn production in the world, in your data, it's decreased only 4%. But why is the price in the world is increasing so much, sometimes more than 20% on
why
corn?
Why the price?
Yeah.
It's because I didn't show demand. I mean, demand is increased. Now, the interesting thing on the demand side is that if you look at fuel, corn used for fuel, for ethanol, that has plateaued a bit. And I think that generally, over the last 3 years, we've been using about the same amount of corn for ethanol use that it's been flat at about 5 billion bushels. It will come down this year by about 10%. But if you look at demand worldwide, globally, that demand has continued to increase at a strong pace,
yeah,
such that even with so that if you have a big drop in production in the U.S., it's enough to really draw down global stock levels.
Not really related with supply and demand, rather than probably some speculation also going on here.
No, I don't think so. I think these are related to fundamentals. I'm not a very big proponent of that this is speculation. I think these are market fundamentals.
30% price increase is so much.
Well,
30% price in the world market for the ingredient is so much.
Demand is very, very sensitive to price, or very insensitive to price. And because of that, you need a very high price increase to send the market signals to ration that demand. And I think that when you see strong growth in foreign markets and in domestic markets for things like fuel, that these are very, very, and for livestock. I mean, you can't just turn this off and say, okay, we'll start eating something else. I think that to get the sort of price or the responses on demand has necessitated a very, very strong price response. I don't think it's speculation.
One more question. One more question.
I'll ask a question here. Dr. Glauber, how much more confident will we become about the actual U.S. corn production, and why would we become more confident than we are today about the number that USDA has published?
Well, if you look at the forecasts, look at the historical record of forecasts, that there's no question the November estimate is slightly better than the October estimate. The October estimate tends to be considerably more accurate than the August estimate. And that's just because, when you go out in the fields in August, you are the plant, it depends on how much has developed, getting grain weights, all of that. We use a lot of model results in August. By the time we're into October, we are actually sampling actual yields, weighing them. We get a much better, much more accurate estimate by the October and the November yield estimates. Now, on the area side, we do true up the area. On the October report, we look at both the survey data in terms of what producers say they planted or harvested. We also look at data from other sources like the Farm Service Agency, and that helps us true up the area numbers. And that's one of the reasons why by the time you get to October, November, you have a pretty good estimate. And the variance between that and the final corn production number is typically quite small. So we have a lot more confidence in those numbers because of that.